Accession number 30018, reel 12.
John Farley, reel 12.
The common thing between the SC1 and the P1127 was reaction controls. This is how do you control the attitude of the, not the height, the attitude of the aeroplane in the hover. How do you, if one wing gets blown down a bit by the wind or something, how do you get that wing tip back up? Well, you would normally, in an ordinary aeroplane, of course, move the aerodynamic surfaces. And if you move those aerodynamic surfaces in a hovering aeroplane, nothing's going to happen because there's no wind over them. And so both types of aircraft have to have reaction controls. That's little jets at the extremities, the nose, the tail, the wingtips and so on, which are connected to the aerodynamic surface. So in both aeroplanes, the pilot moves, instinctively moves the aerodynamic surface, and as if by magic, if you're at low speed, the aerodynamic surface still appears to work. In fact, it's a little puff of air, or it's a big puff of air, actually. They should not be called puffer jets, as the pilots used to call them. I remember John Fuzzell, the chief designer of the Harrier, saying, you know, they're reaction controls. And he didn't like them called puffer jets. Jumping ahead, because it's in context, there is a little puffer jet under the tail of a Harrier to raise the tail or lower the nose. The thrust of that jet in the two-seat Harrier, when it came along later, was greater than the thrust of the first jet aeroplane that Frank Whittle flew, the Gloucester E-2839 in 1940, whatever. And so, you know, these things should not be called puffers. They're not puffing, they are pushing a lot, over 1,000 pounds of thrust in the case of this P1127, sorry, the Harrier two-seater rear nozzle. So the pilot, but to some extent, or to a great extent, these reaction controls were invisible or transparent to the pilot. I say to some extent, from a handling point of view, they were totally transparent. I mean, you moved the stick and the airplane responded. If you're a test pilot, you had to consider the failure cases. You had to consider the health of these newfangled reaction controls, which is normally demonstrated to you excuse me, on gauges showing pressure and that sort of thing. So there was a tendency in the early days to have to keep an eye on a couple of gauges, which went away as soon as we got personal confidence in the kit, but also once we used our common sense and said, hey, wait a minute, the greatest possible indication that the reaction controls are all right is not these gauges, it's the response of the aeroplane. So don't fret about the gauges, you know, just look out the window. And if the thing doesn't work, you'll know soon enough that the reaction controls aren't working. And in fact, the only known case where the reaction controls did not work on a Harrier when the pilot was slowing down and coming into land, it was a Marine, he was flying around a ship, he twigged it, not because he looked at the duct pressure gauge, as it was called, but because the aeroplane was getting soggy and not responding. So, common sense. But it's common sense takes a little time to develop, doesn't it? And when you're faced with a newfangled, roaring, shouting beast, you know, you tend to think about the detail, and it's only later you realise, well, it's actually a bit simpler than this. So you had to think about various matters in preparing yourself to have your first go in one of these things, because of course there were no two-seaters for either aeroplane. So it's really just a matter of sitting in the bath and thinking, and I suppose the modern sports people today, they talk about focusing and all this sort of rubbish, don't they? You know, actually keep your mind on the job sort of thing. And if somebody is in the final at Wimbledon and they're having a glass of orange juice or something and they're having a break between sets, they're sitting there thinking about what they're going to do, or at least hopefully they are, on their this next thing, this next new thing they're going to do, which they haven't done before, which is the tiebreaker of the final, you know? And if you're a test pilot, then it's your job to sit and think about this aeroplane and what you're going to do. So I don't think there's anything very special in it, but it requires a bit of application. It's no good strolling out, smiling at the cameraman and the secretary and so on, without thinking about what you're going to do next. You know, you should actually be thinking about what you're doing. And providing you think about it, you're not going to get surprises. But jumping into an aeroplane, lurching into the air, and then looking for inspiration about what to do next is no way to do it. You need to work it all through in your head first. And that we did. And in my case, other people had flown the SC-1, other people had flown the P-1127, and so I could benefit from a briefing from people who had. But you still actually got to do it yourself, and so yeah, you just think about it.
You mentioned obviously the different types of controls. Was that because you'd flown an awful lot of aircraft at that stage that did have very similar controls, and going into that kind of vertical, well, in the P-1127, mm-hmm. You're saying, you know, was it difficult at first just to, or did you really have to think, I'm moving that forward again, yeah. Like almost relearning to drive, if you used the analogy earlier?
Yeah, sure. There was nothing like that in the SC-1 because it was just like the helicopter. But with the Harrier or the P-1127, yes, you had to think, I am going to control my height by varying the thrust of the engine. So you had to push this throttle forward to go up and pull it back to go down, and that was something you had done in nothing before. Very easy to get it wrong, because as a fighter pilot you were just instinctively controlling speed. Very easy as you come down for your first vertical landing. The airplane is flat, the engine's pointing straight out underneath it. You see the ground coming up, you're an ordinary experienced pilot. What's the first thing you do when you see the ground come up? You pull a stick back. Wrong! You must not do that. Because if you do, you will raise the nose, the engine will point forward a bit, and or the nozzles will point forward a bit, and the airplane will go roaring off backwards. So you had got to stop yourself acting instinctively, and if you like, do it by numbers almost. Preconceived ideas, and you kept them going around in your head, until you had done enough of it that you now had an instinctive reaction. I mean, I had 19 years on these things, and you know, by the time I got to the end of that, even me, you know, had learned how to do it. I might be a slow learner, but in 19 years I can pick things up. And you've become an instinctive hovering pilot in that regard. But in the beginning, no, it isn't, and you've got to think. And so you do a particular manoeuvre which is pre-programmed in your head and pre-briefed, in, you know, and the manoeuvre is going to be a vertical takeoff into the hover and a vertical landing without going anywhere, without moving. That's what it's going to be. And you think, well, I'm going to go to full throttle. The thing will leave the ground. As soon as it's going away from the ground, I keep it flat with my right hand, and I just start bringing the power back. I don't quite know how far this thing's got to come back before it starts coming down, so I'll do it a bit gradually. I'll probably do it too gradually, so you've gone higher than you would wish, but never mind. Okay, so now it's starting to come down. And, it's coming down a bit quick. Right, let's open the throttle a bit. So, and then bump, it's on the ground, and I chop the throttle. So, yeah, you've got to talk yourself through it, sort of thing.
How do you keep it in the hover? How does the aircraft get kept in the hover? Because you mentioned, obviously, how it performs, but how do you get it at that?
Well, you just adjust the thrust so that you don't go up or down. And it is a lot easier to do than talk about. A lot easier to do than talk about. You just look out the window, and if it's coming down, you open the throttle a bit. You've got to get used to how much you move the throttle, but then in your motor car you have to get used to how hard you push on the brakes when you see the traffic lights change, don't you? That's something which you get quite quickly. And the original, we called it a press-up for obvious reasons. You go up in the air and you come straight back down again. That first press-up you do, you may only be airborne for 20 or 30 seconds, because the aim of the game is to leave the ground and then immediately start coming back down to do the landing. There's no merit in whether you go to 30 feet or 80 feet. You know, it makes no difference. And you're going to use less fuel and burn up less time on the engine if you only go to 20 feet. And indeed, I mentioned time on the engine. That was very important in those days. The engine in the P1127 had a 1 hour life. That's 1 hour with the nozzles down. 25 hours with the nozzles aft. Now, this very short life was because the engine was being pushed to its limits to produce enough thrust to get the thing to leave the ground. And the engine was very conservatively rated in terms of how long they would let you hover it before you had to take the engine out of the aeroplane, take it back to the manufacturers at Bristol. They did a strip overhaul on it, took the whole thing apart. There was always at least one blade missing in the back end. So they had it about right at 1 hour. Now, there are two types of blades in the back end. The back end of the engine is the hot bit, and that's where the equipment, the metal, has a hardest time. There are two types of blades, those that are fixed called stators and those that are going round called rotors. If we had lost a rotor blade, then probably the engine would have failed and the aircraft would have crashed. No, it was a stator that we lost, and the stators were much less important. The engine didn't go out of balance if you lost a stator. So when we damaged a stator or it broke free, that wasn't the end of the world at all. But 1 hour, you know, is not long. And the length of the sort of flights we were doing would be measured in seconds rather than minutes. You might do four or five press-ups. Whether it is in your initial conversion or whether it is during some test that you're doing for the boffins. And you might still only have 2 minutes for the logbook. Your logbook and the engine's logbook. When the engine was sent back to Bristol, the overhaul cost £60,000 sterling, which is a lot of money in 1964. And so when you got it back, you had another 60 minutes of hovering. So £1,000 a minute direct engine depreciation in the hover, without all of the other costs of flying an aeroplane. So there was a lot of pressure not to waste time. Great deal of pressure. Which is all fits in very nicely with what was necessary from the pilot's point of view anyhow, and that was to think whatever it was you were going to do right through. Now, you can't think through an hour's trip, you know, but you can think through a 90-second one, you know. And so you decided what you were going to do with your hands, what you were going to do with your eyes, which gauges you're going to look at, what numbers you're going to try and remember, what it was you're going to try and write down, or whatever it was. So you could, you know, you did have this little burst of activity, and you might spend a long time prior to that burst just preparing yourself to be efficient in it. Again, like when you watch a Formula One grid launch off at the start of a new Formula One race, these 16 or 18 guys have all decided how they're going to play this start, you know, according to how they're going to weave past the other guy who stalled or this or that. There's this sudden burst of activity, and you don't get that sort of thing right unless you think it through beforehand.
You mentioned you did probably four or five of those, would you, before you did anything else?
Once you have got this vertical takeoff, hover, vertical landing sorted. And by sorted, I mean you just go straight up 10 or 15 feet, straight back down again. Not a wobble, not a movement. Once you've done that, you're now ready to do the next thing. And the next thing was normally to go up to about 50 or 80 feet deliberately and hold your height there, not immediately start coming down again. So you're learning this business of what is it like to control the thrite, the height on the throttle. That, as I said, was easier said than done. The next thing you're going to do is you go back up into the hover again on another press up. Now you're going to deliberately lower the nose 10 degrees, which will tilt the engine back a bit. The aircraft starts to move forward. You get 50 knots on the airspeed indicator. You now raise the nose 10 degrees. Engines point forward, so the nozzles point forward slightly. You slow the airplane down. And you come back to the hover. So you've learned how to control your forward speed in the hover. Go back, do another landing, do another press up, this time into the hover, and have a look at lateral movement, where you put 5 degrees of bank on and go across the side of the runway and then reverse your bank to stop the travel, and go back towards the centre line and do another landing. So you just sort of broke each thing down into something you could focus on. Then you would also fly the aeroplane conventionally, conventional takeoff, round the circuit, conventional landing. Now you've got to bring the two together. You've got to go from the hover to your wingborne flight. So you've done a fair bit of hovering. You've done one or two conventional circuits. There's no need to do any more. It's just another airplane doing that. And you're another airplane pilot, aren't you, sort of thing. And but now you've got to do the transition. So this time you're going to do... We're talking 1127. We're not talking SC1. You do another vertical takeoff, which is where you pull the nozzle lever back to point the nozzles down. You place the throttle fully forward. You don't creep it up. You place it forward. The engine accelerates rapidly. Up the airplane goes. As soon as it leaves the ground, take your hand off the throttle and put it on the nozzle lever. And then as soon as you're at a safe height to start moving forward, you push that nozzle lever forward. And you push it forward until it gets to the forward stop. When it gets there, you have to be flying on your wings. The only question, of course, is how quickly do you move it? Well, if you were to just place it fully forward suddenly, you would swivel the nozzles round, the airplane would fall on the ground. Albeit it would shoot forward for a second or two before it got to the ground. If you don't move the nozzles, then the aeroplane keeps on going up and up and up. Small pause for a cup of coffee. So this business of going from the hover to your wings, doing an accelerating transition, when you do it for the first time, it is all about how fast am I going to move that lever. If I move it instantly, the thing will fall on the ground. If I don't move it at all, which, if you like, is the ultimate in too slow, then the aeroplane will just go up and up and up. And that gives you the clue. The clue to moving it at the right speed is it becomes your height control. If you're going unnecessarily high, then you're moving it unnecessarily slowly. If the thing starts to sink, you're moving it too quickly. So that's the only thought you need in your head. I'll control the height with my left hand, and I push that lever forward, and if I'm not sinking, it's fine. If I'm going unnecessarily high, I push it a bit quicker. The optimum thing, which would just give you a nice fast level transition, is about 12 or 13 seconds, just to give you a feel for it. So it's a very quick takeoff and onto the wings, much faster than an ordinary aeroplane will do it on the runway, because you've got so much poke in this thing. And when you come back to do your decelerating transition, it is not the reverse at all. So on takeoff, you're moving that nozzle lever as a flying control. You're not moving it as a selection, like undercarriage up, undercarriage down, and nozzles up, nozzles down. You're moving it in response to how the aeroplane flies. It's a flying control. You don't reverse that process. You get on the downwind leg, you're flying normally. You select the nozzles down, all the way down. Just get hold of the nozzle lever, pull it all the way back, thump. Now, what you've done there is to swivel the jets downwards. You didn't have much thrust on at the time, because you don't need much thrust to fly it on the downwind leg. It's got this huge engine. So there might have been a little tiny tendency for the aeroplane to balloon slightly when you put the nozzles down, but you take that out on your right hand instinctively. However, you look at the airspeed indicator now, and it is starting to rush off, because, of course, you've got no thrust, horizontal thrust, to overcome the drag, and the drag of the undercarriage and the flaps and all the rest of it. And so you start pulling the stick back to increase your angle of attack, as you would in any aeroplane when you slow down. But very quickly, you get to the limiting angle of attack, where you must avoid the stall. Now what's going to happen? The speed's still walloping off. Well, you must not pull the nose up anymore. You must open the throttle. So in your head, you select the nozzles down, and then immediately in your head, select hover mode. In other words, I am from now on going to control my thrust on my height on the throttle. So you just switch from wingball mode to hover mode in your head. It is that easy. You know how to hover because you've done it. You just effectively hover it as you approach the airfield, all the way in. I know the world is going by at 120 knots and later at 80 knots and later at 60 knots, you know, but that doesn't mean to say you can't still use this hover in your head idea. So it is. There's no grey area, I suppose, is what I'm saying. It's very black and white. And again, a lot easier to do than talk about. Very much easier and very instinctive once people have done it a few times. There are inherent risks which are more associated with mistakes than a lack of skill. I mean, you can make a mistake and move the wrong lever because you've got both of them for your left hand. But that's not the same as sort of not quite having enough skill. It's a mental stoppage thing, you know. So I'm not suggesting that the Harrier wasn't a bit critical in the circuit. It was very easy to make a mistake and crash. But it was mistakes that you had to make to do that, not errors in skill.
Say you'd selected the wrong lever, would you have enough time to recover, or would you be able to recover?
That's a very, very good question. I mean, Andy Jones, my deputy at Dunsfold, he had a Japanese guy that he was checking out in a two-seat Harrier, close the throttle on him in the hover. Now, fortunately, they were up at nearly 400 feet at the time. And so Andy immediately placed the throttle fully forward, but he had to wait for this engine to re-accelerate, and they stopped coming down about 100 feet up. I had somebody raise the nozzles on me in the hover, in a two-seater, Swiss gentleman, and you've got to get the nozzles down again pretty quickly, as fast as the air motor will let them travel. That's the power control that moves the nozzles. I mean, in fact, I not only yanked the nozzle lever back, I yanked the nose up by pulling the stick back. So, in other words, I was helping the engine go back to pointing down to the ground by using the pitch response of the aeroplane as well as the nozzles going down. So, yes, I mean, whether you can recover, very good question, whether you can recover depends totally on your height and how quick you are to take the correct actions.
So it's rather the circumstances in which the aircraft's in at the time, is it, rather than the ability? Because it can recover, but, again, depending on where you are.
Exactly. Let's have a cup of coffee.
John, can you tell me a little bit about the P1127, how it was configured? Because is it slightly different in how it's undercarriage and that sort of thing from other types of aircraft at that time?
Yes, the configuration of the P1127 was driven, if you like, or forced, or resulted from this huge big engine that had got to go into the centre of the aeroplane. That meant that the wing had got to go on top because you needed a huge hole in the fuselage to get the engine in and out. You couldn't have it in the side, you couldn't have it in the bottom, because there wouldn't have been enough strength in that section of the fuselage to take the normal loads associated with having a tail on the back end. So you have a big hole in the top. Well, you can cover that hole, the wing can be bolted across the top of that hole, literally, and replacing the strength as if there wasn't a hole there. So, yes, you're going to have a high wing configuration with the engine underneath it and the four nozzles on the side, two on each side. You couldn't easily put a tricycle undercarriage on that. If you'd put your two main wheels, attach them to the wing, then you'd have had these very long undercarriage legs because it's a high wing. And long means weak, and long means heavy, and, you know, long, and so you didn't want to do that. You couldn't put the, as is sometimes done, the main legs sticking out sideways from the bottom of the fuselage because the rear nozzles were going to blow straight down on them. So you had to have what's called a bicycle undercarriage, where you have a single main leg. It happens to have two wheels on the bottom of it, but that's a matter of convenience. It's only one leg. When it's on the centre line, and it's a bit behind the centre of gravity. And then you're going to have an ordinary nose wheel, like any aeroplane, any tricycle undercarriage aeroplane has. And then, in order to keep the thing balanced on the ground, you're going to have these little outriggers, or kiddie wheels, on the wingtips. Well, that's fine, but it does mean that it was a different undercarriage configuration to an ordinary aeroplane. This mattered from the undercarriage designer's point of view. You have to design, or you have to decide which legs are going to take the impact of landing on any undercarriage system, and you design those legs to be strong enough. Well, in the case of a bicycle gear, it isn't the nose and the main, it's the main only. So that leg has to be longer so that it hits the ground first and absorbs the impact. Then, as the main leg is absorbing this impact, eventually your nose wheel gets on the ground, you know, assuming you've done your job properly as a pilot. And then the little kiddie wheels get on the ground and the whole thing sits there. Now, the problem is that once the main leg has killed the downwards momentum of 7 or 8 tons of thing coming down on the ground, it has only got the weight of the aeroplane to contend with, and so all four legs have, and so the undercarriage rises up on its springs, and you get freedom laterally, so it flops on one outrigger or the other. This gave real ground handling problems, because with the aeroplane tilted, you know, it wanted to wriggle about on the ground and so on. And it wasn't for many years, about 8 years, until we really got happy with the undercarriage, and it was designed with a self-shortening leg, so that when the main leg, which was longer than all the rest, like we said, and hits the ground first, and it has oil in it, in its oleo, liquid springing system, instead of having rebound, that oil, once it had gone and done its killing the rate of descent job, it wasn't contained in a pressurized compartment, it was allowed to go off sideways into an empty accumulator. So the main leg had no rebound, therefore when it was joined on the ground by the other legs, the aeroplane just sat there. When you next took off, the aeroplane came away from the ground, the weight of the main leg made it come out to its full length, which sucked the oil out of the accumulator and back ready to do another landing. I mean, brilliantly simple. Ralph Hooper came up with the idea, the bloke who conceived the P1127 in the first place, and it produced magnificent ground handling, and all Harriers have had it since.